Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio.
Spice expands life.
I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
Spice expands.
Coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains, an undisclosed location. This is where the past meets the future. In here, all the results are positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are traveling across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, where we came from, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, you will be safely traveling with us. Our AccuWindow forecast tonight, it's about 125 degrees. Humidity must be at least 150%. I know this because my radiator wasn't working all day. I was working out in it. And I know you have been too, sweltering from one side of the nation to the other. The solar wind is whipping at 512 kilometers per second, and there are five sunspot clusters on the sun, with massive sunspot cluster 1520 responsible for an X-class flare that caused some havoc with electrical systems Saturday. Two federal agencies have issued warnings regarding a massive solar flare due to slam Earth sometime today. The latest solar storm to hit Earth in the last 6 months, and probably the most vicious that we've seen all year. Early reports noted that the solar flare would impact Earth in the early hours of Sunday. Astronomers revised the timeline for impact, saying initial projections had a margin of error of 7 hours. So the flare headed toward Earth at some 850 miles per second. As the forerunner solar wind protons continue a steady increase, indicators that the CME is on the way, the wait continues for it to impact Earth's magnetic field. That's NOAA's spokesman. Look for that in the next few hours. If you're listening live, make sure you have your foil hats ready. The weekend solar storm originated from one of the most powerful sun flares to occur this year. The flare registered as an X1.4 class sunstorm, one of the strongest flares the sun can unleash. The strongest is an X9. It is the sixth X-class flare this year, and Philip Chamberlain, an astronomer with NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory, says they are likely to continue through the beginning of 2014 as the sun enters the most active period of its eight-year solar cycle, right on time, according to the ancient Maya calendar. Of course, they knew all about sunspots and solar activity and advanced solar dynamics. Excuse me while I pull my tongue out of my cheek here. Solar activity has a cycle, minimum to maximum to minimum, and it's getting close to the peak of the solar maximum, said NOAA officials. The solar storm erupted from the giant sunspot 1520. It's actually visible with the naked eye. I would recommend using the proper viewing equipment, but you don't need to magnify the sun to see this. It's 186,000 miles across. As for whether the massive solar flare will actually affect Earth, it remains unclear. Officials from the NASA and NOAA both issued alerts and forecasts, but they weren't really coordinated. If we're both thinking the same thing, it can be constructive. At times, this is where we're not thinking the same thing, so it's a little bit awkward, said Joe Kunches, a forecaster at NOAA. It can be a little confusing. The best scenario in the future is for us to have more of a complementary relationship. In other words, you guys need to get the memo here down at NASA, and you need to echo what we say at NOAA. Meanwhile, NASA's Solar Dynamic Observatory captured Thursday's flare, wowing scientists with images of the massive outburst. Officials warn the solar storm could cause havoc. NOAA classified it as an R3 radio blackout, meaning GPS satellite signals degraded for about an hour. And there was a wide area blackout of high-frequency radio communication. I could tell you Saturday we had all kinds of power problems, power turning off, turning on, single phasing. We were doing a bunch of welding on Saturday, and the welders weren't working. The lights would come on, the fan would work, but it was running at about half power. And we realized this because even the fluorescent lights were kind of dim, and one outlet would work and the next one wouldn't. We realized only one phase was coming into the building. A NASA spacecraft has spied a vortex on the south pole of the Saturn moon Titan, hinting that winter may be coming to the huge body's southern reaches. The structure inside the vortex is reminiscent of the open cellular convection that is often seen over Earth's oceans. Tony Del Genio, a Cassini team member at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, said in his statement, "But unlike on Earth, where such layers are just above the surface, this one is at very high altitude, maybe a response of Titan's stratosphere to seasonal cooling as southern winter approaches," he added, but so soon in the game, we're not sure. One of the interesting things about this vortex on Titan, excuse me while I sip my lovely iced grapefruit juice, one of these days I'll learn to talk while I'm doing that, but right now I just really enjoy it. The interesting thing is that these are stratospheric storms, and we don't really have stratospheric storms on Earth, at least yet. You'll remember the book, The Coming Global Superstorm, which was co-authored by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber. It was a non-fiction book, in their opinion, how a superstorm would form. And you remember the movie The Day After Tomorrow, where one of the Quaid brothers starred in a movie where there was a superstorm that formed over most of the planet, Europe, Scotland, Canada, down to about the Mason-Dixon line. And literally dumped snow, you know, so deep that it just buried some buildings. And then this high stratospheric vortex formed, pulling super cold air, 100 to 200 degrees below zero, down to the surface and literally just super freezing everything. Even the fuel froze in the lines of the helicopters, you remember, and then they crashed. That movie, even though the credits didn't mention it, that movie was based on the book The Coming Global Superstorm. And Titan is kind of a model for this. Now, when Cassini arrived at the Saturn system in 2004, 8 years ago, Titan, which is 3,200 miles wide, had a vortex and a visible hood of relatively dense haze high above its north pole. A similar hood is what we see in our really, really bad thunder heads. You know how the cold air will whip across the top of the cloud and extend it sort of like an anvil shape off the top of the cloud system, way, way up about 55,000 feet. And this sort of a Van de Graaff generator is what, you know, whips up these ion buildup, this huge electron buildup in the cloud, and then that's what discharges to Earth and why the thunderstorms are so devastating. Well, this happens on Titan. It's a little bit, about half the size of Earth, maybe a little less than half the size of Earth, but these high-altitude storms do happen. It was winter there until Saturn's August 2009 equinox, which marks the arrival of spring in the northern hemisphere, and fall in the southern reaches of the planet and its many moons. While Titan's northern hood still remains, the circulation in the upper atmosphere has been moving from the warming North Pole to the cooling South, researchers said. This shift appears to be causing downwellings over Titan's south pole, along with the formation of high altitude haze and a vortex there. It's actually quite spectacular to see if you look at the Cassini pictures. Cassini cameras first noticed the nascent southern hazes in March of this year, and the spacecraft's visual and infrared mapping spectrometer system, called VIMS, captured false color images on May 22nd and June 7th. VIMS has seen a concentration of aerosols forming about 200 miles above the surface. This is Christopher Soten, a VIMS team member at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. We've never seen aerosols here at this level before, so we know this is something new. Well, it's got to be global warming, that's all I can say. I'm kidding. Cassini scientists will keep a close, no, I'm not, close eye on Titan's south pole for further developments, which could shed light on the moon's complex methane-based weather system. First observations of this feature will provide good tests of dynamical models of the Titan circulation chemistry, cloud and aerosol processes in the upper atmosphere. And this is Bob West, the Cassini deputy imaging team lead at JPL. It makes for a nice business card, folks, but it's not a real high salary. Polar vortices aren't uncommon in our solar system. They've also been observed on Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune, Earth, and Venus, researchers said. We have not had a superstorm yet. If you'll remember the dynamics of it in the movie, these storms form a northern kind of massive hurricane formation. Now, we've had this actually occur almost two or three times in the last couple of decades. What we have seen, this is from about, I guess, the late 80s, 80, 86, 87, we started seeing these big storms, nor'easters and also over Alaska. But they were kind of small, a couple of slices of the pie. But if you'll remember, go back and listen to the archives of X Squared Radio last year, there was a superstorm cell that settled over Alaska and dumped 90-mile-an-hour winds and blizzard conditions. Alaska has never seen record snowfalls for Alaska. And for Alaska, a record is a big record. We're talking 32 feet of snow in one storm. Now, Alaskans are tough, and they can weather this kind of stuff, and the roofs are built for it, and they have, you know, Eskimo women, I'm kidding, they have, you know, the ability to weather this kind of cold weather without much inconvenience, staying around the shanty and watching cable TV for extended periods of time. But the important part is that these counterclockwise, at least in the northern hemisphere, rotating giant storms, once they form the full hurricane structure, you have the makings of a superstorm. Now, I'm not just talking about the high winds, and I'm not just talking about the snowfall. That's two-thirds of it right there. The last third of it is where this vortex becomes very structured, like Katrina was structured, only that's a little bit far south for what we're talking about here. If something like that forms way up in the high latitudes, 40, 50, 60th parallel, what you see is that these things can then access the stratosphere, super cold air, 120, 150 below zero. Now, admittedly, it's very thin, but it's not the mass of the atmosphere that's important. It's the temperature. Once this icy air gets hooked into this vortex, it pulls down, sort of like being sucked down the drain of a bathtub. And once it reaches the surface, it absorbs a tremendous amount of energy. In other words, it chills everything. It's one thing to see, 30 below, 40 below, but when you get to 70 and 80 and 90 below, things that are liquid normally freeze. Antifreeze freezes. Oil becomes solid. Grease doesn't work anymore. Metals become very brittle. Things that are normally flexible, like rubber and bananas and things like that, become brittle and shatter. It can become devastating. And if you're caught out in it, it's deadly. you cannot breathe this air into your lungs, okay? This is like breathing air from a blast freezer, a CO2 blast freezer. You cannot withstand this for very long. And no homes that are made in North America, other than maybe the ones made in Alaska, if you're buried in snow, can survive this kind of cold temperature. Just not made for it. That's a superstorm. So when we observe these, now admittedly it's in a methane-based atmosphere, but when we see the models on other planets in our solar system and we see the rarity of it and then the frequent occurrence of it, it sets up a pattern for us, and we should have more than one department looking at models like that, discussing the possibilities. What could we do about it? Well, there are a lot of things we could do about it. We can evacuate. We can provide for supplies, emergency supplies in those areas that might be affected. We can improve our communication systems and our early warning systems so that we can get people out or get aid in. Just something to consider. I know it right now it's the last thing on our mind is the jacket in our closet. At least it has been on mine. It's been over 90 every day here for over 30 days, and I don't see any relief in sight. We'll go through July, August, and most of September above 90 degrees here east of the Appalachians, and I think even the Northeast has been suffering. You couple that with the idea that with all these air conditioners running, all these heat pumps running, that's a lot of amps that's being pulled during the daylight hours. It's a lot of strain for a long, hot day and on into the evening for the power grid. When you add to that a couple of million volts per mile thrown onto the power lines from the sun, and it has the system designed for disaster. You have large gauge aluminum wire that is the high tension line that you see stretched all over the country. Then you have the aluminum lines going on the telephone poles in just about every city in America, unless you have underground utilities. And then you have the substations that are stepping down that high voltage, 200,000 volts, 161,000 volts, stepping that down to 13,800 volts. Then in the regional substations to 4160, and then 440, and then 220, and then it comes to your house. So all of that load is a target for a solar overload. And I really thought we were going through it this Saturday, because I've never seen a power behave that way unless we're really having grid problems. And haven't seen anything in the news, but that's not necessarily something that that they would panic people about, a solar storm. We just don't, unless you watch news every now and then or listen to Michio or myself, you're not really alarmed about solar storms. But just to give you an idea that weather is doing some strange things and it's causing strange stresses on the system. Now, let's switch to history really quickly. One of the tragedies of ancient history is when wow, that grapefruit juice is so good. Tropicana is my brand. Pink, for those of you that are wondering. That way you can imbibe at the same time that I'm imbibing on the program, and you can get in the same mood that I'm in. One of the tragedies is when military forces mix with religious fanaticism. I'm going to call it religiosity, insanity. These soldiers move in and they receive orders that the conquering religion is right, and the quasi-religious artifacts that are left behind by ancient civilizations are heresy and must be destroyed. And so I want you to aim your cannons at the following antiquities and deface them. Blow them off the face of the earth. Those of you that have been to Egypt with me or with William or with Some of the other tour groups that were out there, they're no more, by the way. No more tours to Egypt. I don't care what anybody says. Don't have your passport stamped in Egypt. I don't care what friends you have there. If you're American, find another vacation this winter. If you tour Egypt, you see many of the ancient sites have been hammered and defaced by subsequent dynasties that came along that said, whatever message those ancients were trying to pass along to the next generation or make a statement to eternity by carving it in stone, we're gonna deface it. And so they take hammers and just beat the bas reliefs and the carvings to pebbles. And that's what we have left behind. In some cases, they actually move the cannons in and start shelling it. I've been to Tibet and went to the town of Shigatse. Shigatse is in the upper plateau of Tibet. It's quite cold. It sits at about 14,700 feet. It takes a week or so to get acclimated at 11,000 feet to be able to go up that high and walk around and stuff. Shot some film there, did some pictures there, did some very rare stuff, most of which is in the second volume of the Ark of Millions of Years. Some of it's in the third volume of the Ark of Millions of Years. And I am putting together a book outline for a book of my travels over the last 10 years so that you can keep up with me. Or at least go with me, because these are pretty tough trips to go on. But in any case, what happened when the Chinese took over Tibet is they rolled the army in and they had alert towers along the way as the Chinese army was marching in. And they would bang the gong, you know, with a big log against it. And that would be heard up the valley. And then the next one would relay it forward and the next one would relay it forward. And they got to Shigatse, which was a walled city. And the Chinese began to shell the city. Now, the city was built under the lines and guidances of Tibetan Buddhism, which was established in the 7th century. So this is quite ancient. These people are quite isolated. They were amazing craftsmen. I'm talking mandalas that would just blow your mind. Well, the Chinese began shelling the place. And the Tibetans, you know, weren't geared up to fight back. They just sort of sat there in meditation and let the shells hit. And after a few days, the Chinese said, hey, dudes, you know, what are we doing here? I mean, we're taking orders from 5,000 miles away, and, you know, these people aren't fighting back. What's to conquer? Let's just walk in. So they stopped shelling, and they walked in, and Shigatse happens to be, unfortunately for its location, sitting on top of one of the largest iron deposits in Tibet. It is a gigantic iron mountain, and there's tons of crystal in the structure and other precious metals and minerals. And this is an ancient city. You know, it goes back 15 centuries, way back. Anyway, the problem is that you have to wipe out all these antiquities and relocate all these people in order to get at it. Fortunately, that has not happened, or at least it didn't happen in 2007 when I went there. It was still pretty much intact. One of the Panchen Lamas had become quite wealthy and had spent millions of dollars refurbishing the most ancient parts of Shigatse, literally donating all of his money to refurbishing some of these areas, not for tourists per se, but for pilgrims, because the Tibetan people are quite faithful, and they make sometime in their lives a pilgrimage. They literally crawl like an inchworm from their home to these temples, and of various ones, and they go there to cast upon these relics, these likenesses of various gods, whether it's Avalokiteshvara, or which is the god with a thousand hands, each hand with an eye in it, so that he can see and care for all of the people. Or it's one of the others that takes cares away, or fights enemies, or, you know, promises prosperity. They make their pilgrimages to these places that have been restored by this Panchen Lama. So the thing to pay attention to here is that these relics are very important. And it is a tragedy to the world, to the human race, when a conquering race that is mixed with zealous, insane religiosity to call for the destruction of that relic. And one of the most famous in the world, even though it wasn't appreciated by the people who inherited it. According to several reports, in the Arabic media, prominent Muslim clerics have begun to call for the demolition of Egypt's Great Pyramids. Or in other words, of the Saudi Sheikh Ali bin Zayed Al Rabi'i, those symbols of paganism which Egypt's Salafi party has long planned to cover with wax. Most recently, Bahrain's Sheikh of Sunni Sheikhs and President of National Unity, Abd al-Latif al-Mahmoud, called on Egypt's new president, Mohamed Morsi, to destroy the pyramids and accomplish what the Sahabi Amr bin al-As could not. This is a reference to the Muslim prophet Muhammad's companion, Amr bin al-As, as his Arabian tribesmen who invaded and conquered Egypt circa 641. Under al-As and subsequent Muslim rule, many Egyptian antiquities were destroyed as relics of infidelity, as I had discussed earlier. While most Western academics argue otherwise, according to early Muslim writers, the Great Library of Alexandria itself, deemed a repository of pagan knowledge contradicting the Quran, was destroyed under bin al-As's reign and in compliance with Caliph Omar's command. However, while book burning was an easy activity in the 7th century, destroying the mountain-like pyramids and their guardian sphinx was not. Even if Egypt's medieval Mamluk rulers denounced the latter during target practice, though popular legends still attribute to a Westerner, Napoleon. Now, however, as Bahrain's Sheikh of Sheikhs observes, and thanks to modern technology, the pyramids can, in fact, be destroyed. The only question left is whether the Muslim Brotherhood, president of Egypt, is pious enough, if he is willing to complete the Islamization process that started under the hands of Egypt's first Islamic conqueror. Nor is such a course of action implausible. History is laden with examples of Muslims destroying their own pre-Islamic heritage, starting with Islam's prophet Muhammad himself, who destroyed Arabia's Kaaba temple, transforming it into a mosque. Well, the destruction of the pyramids has been tried before. All of the limestone, of course, has been stripped off the outside, the capstone removed, the Sphinx defaced, the front of the Great Pyramid blown open, all of whatever was inside the temple or inside the pyramid at the time is gone. But for all of that, Giza is the biggest draw of money into Egypt, the antiquities. Asking, what is it about Islam that so often turns its adherents against their own patrimony? Daniel Pipes provided several examples from medieval Muslims in India destroying their forefathers' temples to contemporary Muslims destroying their non-Islamic heritage in Egypt, Iraq, Israel, Malaysia, and Tunisia. Currently, in what the International Criminal Court is describing as a possible war crime, Islamic fanatics are destroying the ancient heritage of the city of Timbuktu in Mali, all to Islam's triumphant war cry. Allahu Akbar. Much of this hate for their own pre-Islamic heritage is tied to the fact that traditionally Muslims do not identify with this or that nation, culture, heritage, or language, but only with the Islamic nation, the Ummah. Accordingly, while many Egyptians, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, see themselves as Egyptians, Islamists have no national identity, identifying only with Islam's culture based on the Sunnah of the Prophet and Islam's language, Arabic. This sentiment was clearly reflected when the former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Muhammad Akef, declared the hell with Egypt, indicating that the interests of his country are secondary to Islam's. It is further telling that such calls are being made now, immediately after a Muslim Brotherhood member became Egypt's president. In fact, the same reports discussing the call to demolish the last of the seven wonders of the world also note that Egyptian Salafis are calling on Morsi to banish all Shias and Baha'is from Egypt. In other words, Morsi's call to release the blind sheikh, a terrorist mastermind, may be the tip of the iceberg in coming audacity. From calls to legalize Islamic sex slave marriage, to calls to institute morality police, to calls to destroy Egypt's mountain-like monuments under Muslim Brotherhood tutelage, the bottle has been uncorked and the genie unleashed in Egypt. With all those international institutions which make it a point to look the other way whenever human rights abuses are committed by Muslims, lest they appear Islamophobic, at least take note now that the Great Pyramids appear to be next on Islam's hit list. Or will the fact that Muslims are involved silence them once again, even as those most ancient symbols of human civilization are pummeled to the ground? Just in case you think that this is going unnoticed or unendorsed, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has met with the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt and approves. You want to discuss that? Those of you that have been to Egypt, Diane, others out there, you want to call in and we'll talk about it. 888-429-5471. Don't forget, our conference line is working tonight. 760-569-7676. You must dial the passcode 192919#. And then you can listen by cell phone. Now, if you have an Android phone, you're in luck, because I have created an app for the Android, and it's available with one click at xsquaredradio.com. All you have to do is click on the app, download it to your phone, and you can listen to BBS Radio Channel 2 any time you like. Hopefully it's during X Squared Radio. So if you want to discuss the unbelievable modern day, I mean, this is the 21st century, people. Modern day destruction of one of the seven wonders of the world. Give me a call, because I think it is unfathomable. I have been in the pyramids for a total of 3 days in my life. That's more than most people do if they go as tourists, and more than anyone can do now, because no Westerners are going to be going to the pyramids, I can tell you that. I don't care who you know. You're taking your life and the presence of you for the rest of your family in your own hands, and you're foolish if you go to Egypt right now as a Westerner. You're in really, really dangerous territory if you go. I am blessed that I was able to go. I sacrificed to go. I was pleased with the memory. I have tons of film, which I will share at subsequent conferences throughout the world. But we may lose these pyramids once and for all. Here we are in the 21st century, and there is now a call for the world's fastest growing religion to turn Giza into a parking lot. You got it. What a great world we live in. That calls, I'm going to have to wash that down my throat. Hold on. Okay, let's talk about something uplifting. You know, when I was a kid in Southern California, one of the things that my cousins and I used to love to do was collect comic books and collect baseball cards. Now, I had boxes of Spider-Man comics. I don't know how far back they went, but I think I go all the way back to issue 10, the original Spider-Man comics. I've read them all. That's why I was so excited when Spider-Man came out. And I'm generally excited about all the Marvel comic movies because the creator of Marvel Comics is still alive and he's still an advisor on all these films. And the characters are not only developed, of course, for their, you know, phenomenal powers and abilities, which the creator gives them in his creation, but also their flaws, the personal side of it, the thing that they wrestle with, the sacrifices that they make to have their superpowers. And I stored all of these carefully in their plastic slipcovers and boxes, and then I enlisted into the Air Force in 1972. I went active in 1973. I went in the summertime to basic training, the lovely paradise of San Antonio, Texas, Lackland Air Force Base. And I went through that, and then 5 months of technical training, which I was only halfway through, but we got a Christmas break. Took a week at Christmas and went from Denver, Colorado, back to San Marino, which is a subdivision of Pasadena, more or less. It's a wealthy bedroom community, although we were not wealthy. We lived in a rental of my aunt's. And my aunt's house is where I had stored all of those things that I couldn't take to basic training with me. I had brought a car with a sizable trunk, and I wanted to collect my collectibles. I had some models that I had built, some World War II airplane models, comic books, and baseball cards, and transport them, you know, forward with me, you know, for the rest of my life, take them with me. Unfortunately, my aunt had in her drunken stupor a yard sale, and all of my comics and all of my baseball cards and all of my World War II models, everything that was valuable to me that I'd collected in my life up to that point was gone. Well, it doesn't always happen that way. In a story by John Sewer of Associated Press, there is a better story. Carl Kisner picked up a soot-covered cardboard box that had been under a wooden dollhouse in his grandfather's attic. Taking a look inside, he saw hundreds of baseball cards bundled with twine. They were smaller than the ones he was used to seeing, but some of the names were familiar. Hall of Famers, Ty Cobb, Cy Young, Honus Wagner. Then he put the box on a dresser and went back to digging through the attic. It wasn't until 2 weeks later that he learned that his family had come across what experts say is one of the biggest, most exciting finds in the history of sports card collecting. A discovery worth perhaps millions. The cards are from an extremely rare series issued around 1910. Up to now, the few known to exist were so-so condition at best. with faded images and worn edges, but the ones from the attic in the town of Defiance are nearly pristine, untouched for more than a century. The colors are vibrant, the borders crisp and white. It's like finding the Mona Lisa in the attic, Kisner said. Sports car experts who authenticated the finds say they may never see something this impressive. Every future find will ultimately be compared to this, said Joe Orlando, president of Professional Sports Authenticator. The best of the bunch, 37 cards. They're expected to bring a total of $500,000 when they are sold at auction in August during the National Sports Collectors Convention in Baltimore. There are about 700 cards in all that could be worth up to $3 million, experts say. They include such legends as Christy Mathewson and Connie Mack. Kisner and his family say the cards belong to their grandfather, Carl Hinch, who died in the 1940s. Hinch ran a meat market in Defiance, and the family suspects he got them as a promotional item from a candy company that distributed them with caramels. They think he gave some away and kept others. We guess he stuck them in the attic and forgot about them, Kisner said. They remained there, frozen in time. After Hinch and his wife died, two of his daughters lived in the house. Jean Hinch kept the house until she died last October, leaving everything inside to her 20 nieces and nephews. Kisner, 51, is the youngest and was put in charge of the estate. His aunt was a pack rat, and the house was filled with three generations of stuff. They found calendars from the meat market, turn-of-the-century dresses, a steamer trunk from the Germany, and a dresser with grandma's clothes neatly folded in the drawers. Months went by before they even got to the attic. On February 29th, Kisner's cousin Carla Hinch pulled out the dirty green box with metal clips at the corners and lifted the lid. Not knowing whether the cards were valuable, the two cousins put the box aside. But Kisner decided to do a little research. The cards were at his office in the restaurant he owns when he realized they might have something. He immediately took them across the street and put them in a bank vault. Still not knowing whether the cards were real, they sent eight to expert Peter Calderon at Heritage Auctions in Dallas, which recently sold the baseball card that rolled through the legs of a Boston Red Sox first baseman, Bill Buckner, in the 1986 World Series for $418,000. Calderon said his first words were, "Oh, my God. I was in complete awe," he said. "You just don't see them this nice." The cards are from what is known as the E98 series. It is not clear who manufactured them or how many were produced, but the series consists of 30 players, all of them Hall of Famers. The experts at Heritage Auctions checked out the family's background, the age of the home, and the history of the meat market. They looked at the cards and how they were printed. "Everything lines up," said Chris Ivey, the company's director of sports auctions. They then sent all the cards to Professional Sports Authenticator, which had previously authenticated fewer than 700 E98s. The Ohio cards were the finest examples from the E98 series the company had ever seen. The company grades cards on a 1 to 10 scale based on of their condition. Up to now, the highest grade it ever given a Ty Cobb card from E98 series was a 7. 16 Cobbs found in the Ohio attic were graded at 9, almost perfect. A Honus Wagner was judged at 10, a first for the series. Retired sports card auctioneer Barry Sloade of New York City said, "This is probably the most interesting find I've heard of. The highest price ever paid for a baseball card is $2.8 million, handed over in 2007 for a 1909 Honus Wagner that was produced by the American Tobacco Company and included in packs of cigarettes. Another similar Wagner card brought $1.2 million in April, Wagner's tobacco cards were pulled from circulation, either because the ball player didn't want to encourage smoking among children or because he wanted more money. Heritage Auctions planned to sell most of the Ohio cards over the next 2 of 3 years through auctions and private sales so that it doesn't flood the market. In all, they could bring 2 million or 3 million, Ivy said. The Hench family is evenly dividing the cards and the money among the 20 cousins named in their aunt's will. But a few have decided to sell their shares. These cards need to be with those people who appreciate and enjoy them, Kistner said. What a wonderful, wonderful story. Much better. Much better. We like that much better. I hope that the cards never fall into the hands of Islamists. I don't know what a Spider-Man issue number 10 is worth. I don't want to know. But I had one. And 11. And 12. And 13. And 14. Boxes of them in series. In plastic. Red, but in great condition. There's a lot going on in the world. And I'm sure you know more than I do, because you're out there, and I'm working virtually all the time. So what I would really appreciate your call, 888-429-5471. I've had several of you write me and call me and say that you're listeners, and that's the only time I've ever heard your voice. Don't be afraid. You can call. We'll talk. I know sometimes I was at the East Eddy Ranch a couple of weeks ago, and people said how much they appreciate this program, and I got to tell you, that's really what keeps me going here. We're in our eighth year this coming August. We'll be in our eighth year at BBS Radio, and I have thoroughly enjoyed my time here and have no plans to quit. You have been my friends. And I've enjoyed spending time with you and sharing my thoughts with you each Sunday evening. I'm going to try to make some website upgrades this year. Not sure how it'll look. We made some upgrades last year thanks to a volunteer that helped. And I tried my best to learn the code and, you know, being your own main webmaster. Sometimes I make mistakes. I don't get the links correct, or I miss a period, or I capitalize something I shouldn't capitalize, and it turns out not to be a working link. Keep me honest, folks. If you find that, Earth Explorers, please do not hesitate to write me. I will jump on the computer and change it. Sometimes I get busy, and I don't double-check myself, and I should. One of the things that we're going to cover more heavily, because we're into the political science of this time that we're in, this will be our third election series that we're going through with you. We started prior to 2006, so we've done 2006, 2010, and we're going to do 2012 with you. The 2008 election changed everything. We were going along sweet. We had grown unbelievably, ready to hire. We had interviewed over 400 people, selected a good crew of 68 to start up the plant, had our incentives in place, had our people in place, had our building in place, some of our equipment in place. And then the election of 2008 occurred. All of that came to an end. All of the things that we had approved went to Congress and sat there and aged and died. None of those 400 people found jobs. In the second most economically challenged congressional district in the entire nation, it was utterly and completely ignored. And we've heard the politics back and forth, one claim and then another, and Lord knows we're not even to Labor Day, and we're already seeing the most devastating rhetoric between two candidates for presidency. Hey, before I get into this, we have talked about the destruction of the Giza pyramids by the Muslim Brotherhood. And I had asked my good friend Diane from Michigan, who's been there a couple times. I've been there a couple times. By the way, she was on the streets as an American tourist during the Arab Spring. I was there, and then 2 weeks later, this whole thing came apart, and she was there. My good friend, Diane. Welcome to the program, Diane.
Brooks, long time no talk to. I wanted to call you about the solar flares.
What's that?
I want to call you about the solar flares.
Oh, yeah.
I live in KPAC, all right, little town just in the thumb of Michigan. And today, our power went out once, twice, and then three times. No storms. We haven't had rain in weeks and weeks. Occasional, you know, a little bit here and there. It went up 10 o'clock this morning, and finally at 5 o'clock, and I have a generator. Something went wrong with my generator. The generator went totally out. And so I went up into the city, which is, you know, a mile away, and checked with what they were doing, and they said a transformer blew and just hit the ground. No storm, no rain, no nothing.
That's exactly
and my
how
power solar finally went back on at 7:30 tonight.
That's exactly how a solar storm affects it. We've talked about it many times on this program. The extra solar voltage goes onto the line, and the step-down transformer becomes a step-up transformer, and it melts the transformer down. You're lucky
exactly
it was just
what happened, and it fell to the ground.
That's right. It melts
and
the core.
And, you know, when I talked to the gentlemen that were working on it from DTE, they said they have no – I said – was it part of the solar? They said, "What are you talking about?" they had no clue.
You know, and I think that's negligent, Diane, because these guys are going to be climbing up in buckets doing service on those lines.
Yes.
And there's not going to be thousands of volts. There's going to be millions of volts on those lines.
Exactly. And I want to tell you something. And then I put my generator on. My generator has always work full power. I have a huge generator, and it's a tri. It's a tri-generator, so it works on three different velocities of energy. So it's gasoline, propane, and natural gas. And I have it hooked up to a 500-gallon pig. And
nice.
And it came on, and it shut down.
Wow.
It came on. As soon as I went out there and powered it up, never have had this before. Never. And I've used it through ice storms, never used it in the summer. This is the first time ever in the summer. But we've had ice storms. We lose power a lot out here. And I crank it up, no problem, turn the key, you know, and no problem. This time, no energy whatsoever.
That is amazing. That's amazing. And, you know, that's the way solar flares work, these geomagnetic storms.
Well, that's what I wanted to call to share with you, because if other people are having the same problem, mine is not one that automatically kicks in when the power goes out. I have to actually go out there into the pole barn and actually, do the whole thing that you have to do. Turn the generator on, you know, put the fuel on, and click it from AC, you know, from power to the house, power to the generator. And I've never, I test that every 30 days. And it has always worked. Today, it did not work.
That's amazing. I know yesterday we were in the shop.
Brooks, I think we're in for something bigger than what we even expected. You know what? And the first thing that went through my mind, and when I went up there and they said, "We're hoping to get it up by midnight." And I go, "Oh, my God, how am I going to do without the Internet till midnight? How am I going to do without listening to Brooks Agnew till midnight? What am I going to do?" I was beside myself. I got my shortwave radio out. I started clicking it on, and I go, Oh, my gosh. And I don't have TV anywhere. I don't have cable. I don't have TV, nothing. But I'm going, holy moly.
What do you think
anyways,
about...
Anyways, I just wanted to call and share that with you. If there's anybody else that has had any disruptions in their electricity with no explanation, no
yeah,
thunder, no...
We
haven't had rain here for, you know, six weeks.
Diane, we were in the shop yesterday working on the electric truck, getting it ready for a show for the military, and our power did the same thing. The whole shop's power went out 5 or 6 times yesterday. No storms, no nothing. Street lights were out, came back on, went out, came back on. We're experiencing the same thing down here in Charlotte.
Well, is it by coincidence or is it by plan?
No, I think we got one barrel of the shotgun. I think
I think you're right.
The sun's aimed at us, and it's only a matter of time. We are definitely an electronic society, and a solar flare is going to have a much more economic impact now than it did in 1859 when the Carrington event occurred. My question, Diane, I wanted to know how you felt about the calls by the Muslim Brotherhood to destroy the pyramids as a symbol of the infidel. What are your feelings about that?
I think that's a call tactic of again, control and fear. I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that, again, we're at a parallel time that things are exploding exponentially in every avenue. It doesn't matter. It's our politics, their politics. You know, everything is a crisis right now. Everything is in a fear mode because they feed off of fear.
Yeah.
And as long as we continue to buy into the fear program, we just cannot acknowledge it. It doesn't matter to what. There's no accidents. Everything. There's no coincidence. This is happening by design. Just like when I was in Egypt, just like it was held for 3 more days that I couldn't get out. You know, they locked down the internet. We couldn't make any contact. There was nothing we could do. We were just, like, helpless. Well, you know what? That's what I felt today in my own home, in my own city, with no electricity, with a backup generator that didn't work. And it has always worked. And I want to tell you that there are many people across this country that are getting, you know, they're backed up with generators and so forth. But I want to tell you, when those EMPs come down, those solar flares come down, those new generators, and mine, I bought mine in 1999, even then, I think that they had something in them, just like the cars and everything. They shut them right down.
Yep, the microelectronics, the computers, are affected by it.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I think that we're in for something that we're getting ready to rock and roll, and it's evident everywhere. It's evident in every avenue. And you see it, I see it. I'm sorry I wasn't there at East City this year. Excuse me, but I had a real – the last time I was there – I drove across the country because I had a real problem with TSA.
Uh-huh.
And TSA had already done me through, and I said, you know what? Either I drive across the country or I'm going to jail. And so I drove across the country, broke down 3 times, but made it there nonetheless. And this year it was I had a real bad experience in Albuquerque, excuse me, last year. And I was arrested and released immediately, but nevertheless, it could have gotten a lot worse.
Well, what were you trying to do?
I think at this point we have to stand up and we have to say no. We are not going to put up with this.
You mind sharing what happened to you on your TSA experience? Because it couldn't be a little bit unlike what happened to Rand Paul. You know, he's a sitting senator. Everyone knows who he is. And yet he opted, you know, not to go through the search because he had gone through the scanner clean. didn't have anything on him, and he didn't want to be patted down, and he missed his flight and could have been jailed just like you were. What happened?
Well, that's what happened to me. And what happened to me was I was going through, everything was fine. They went through all my luggage, took off my shoes. You know, I'm short of taking off my bra and underpants. Went through, and then they pulled me over and said I had to go through the radiation detector. I said, I will not. I will not go through that. That has been proven that unzips the DNA, and it totally distorts it. And I'm going to tell you something right now, and everybody who's listening to this program tonight can do their own research on it. And I suggest that everyone does their own research. Do not listen to me or Brooks or anybody else that you hear on the internet without doing your own research. And well, and I refused to do that, and so they sent me over to be patted down. I told them, I said, you touch one private body part of mine, and I will sue you. And they said, you know what, we're calling over our supervisor because you don't threaten us.
Right. Yeah, so what happened?
Well, at that point, they called over the supervisor, and I said to him, I said, I'm going to tell you something. You can pat me down. Do not touch my breast or any of my private parts because I will sue you. And I am a legal paralegal, and I know my rights. And they did exactly. They patted me down very lightly. In fact, they barely touched me.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you something. Unless you stand up for those rights, you are going to be trampled over and over again, because what they want is total control and fear, because they feed off of fear.
Well,
that's not what I called you about. I called you about the solar flares, and I really didn't want to get off on this tangent. But anyways, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I agree with you. I've seen people not unlike you in the line ahead of me, in the line behind me. They just say, hey, look, you know, Osama bin Laden's dead. What is all this? I want my airport back. You know, I got to the airport an hour and a half early, and I got to stand in this stupid line while you frisk me, you know, illegal search and seizure of everything that I own. When's the last time you guys found something? If you look at the TSA report, last year, they found nothing, zero, zip, nada, nothing. And they wanted another $50 million added to their budget.
Oh, yeah. I let me just tell you a real short story. Along with me was a friend. And she came in, and they searched her bags, and they pulled her aside. They were almost going to take her in the back room. And I said, and I already, you know, kind of briefed her. I said, whatever you do, do not let them get the upper hand. So anyways, they pulled out in the very bottom of her backpack. She had a tube of Crest toothpaste, the sampler kind, the kind you go in and buy at the store that's good for like 1 or 2 days.
Yeah.
And it was the new Crest. It was a new Crest toothpaste, and it had gold flecks in it. Mm-hmm. They brought this out, and they squirted it all over the counter and ran their fingers through it, wanting to know what the gold flecks were. And she said, wait a minute, I bought this at the store. I don't know what the hell it is.
Wow.
I mean, it was really pathetic. It was really, you know, so you have to find different ways to try, you know what, none of us want to travel by car across the country, and now we're getting these checkpoints and so forth. I don't know where, but I only have to say to the American people of this country and all the people of this country, whether you're American or you're not, if you want freedom, you're going to have to fight for it. You're going to have to stand up, and you're going to have to say no.
I agree.
And if more of us did this, then we would not have this problem.
That's very possible. I agree. You know, we should make it easy for them. I always wondered how the Nazis took over Europe. They were outnumbered. I don't think they were outgunned, but they were definitely outnumbered. And, you know, six soldiers could take down 1,000 people and march them, into trains and take them off to gulags take them off to prison camps, and nobody would put up a fight. Well,
now, get ready, America, because that's what your future is like unless you stand up and say no right now. And what's happened in the past and what's happened in history is going to repeat itself unless we, and that's what I believe these solar flares are about. Because I believe, and this is going to probably shake a lot of people up, the Son of God, the Son of the Creator, is the S-U-N, not the S-O-N.
Well, maybe he's both. Diane, I appreciate
maybe
the call.
Both.
I'm all over
right.
The time.
Have a great evening.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You for, Love you. Thank you for your program.
Thank you very much, Diane. Bye-bye. All right, let's take a quick break. We're over time. Not that I have any affiliates out there, but we just need to try to stay on schedule. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Sun has finally gone down, and the temperatures finally got below 90 degrees. It's been a real scorcher again today, although the humidity wasn't as high. It was almost bearable. By the way, that was After the Gold Rush, Neil Young's song, and it was sung by the Alice Band, for those of you that are out there looking for that tune. One of the things that people are concentrating on right now is jobs. We talk about it in the news all the time. It's the subject of the day. And I told you, I began telling the story for a caller in the last hour, Diane from Michigan, that I had started up a company in eastern Kentucky and in the previous administration had at least some support. Not in the form of money, but in the form of some regulatory openings that would allow the hiring of 68 and then ramp up to, close to 400 people to manufacture here in the United States. Well, all that came to an end. That was 4 years ago. And one of the things that, we're always looking for is an opportunity to support those that want to start employment here or start something to get the economy moving. Well, the outsourcer in chief has taken some of the most proud and greatest achievements this country has ever known and outsourced them. This morning, Kazakhstan time, the next mission to the International Space Station successfully blasted off, carrying the usual trio, a Russian commander, an astronaut from the international community, and an American, in a seat rented by NASA since the retirement of the last U.S. space shuttle a year ago this month. The Soyuz spacecraft, Expedition 32, had Yuri Malenchenko as the commander, flight engineer Sunita Williams of NASA and Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency flight engineer Akihiko Hoshide. When they dock with the space station Tuesday, they will bring the International Space Station crew back up to its usual complement of six. The trio there is scheduled to end its tour and return to Earth on September 17th, while the newest three will orbit the Earth until just before American Thanksgiving. NASA TV, of course, will carry the live coverage of the Tuesday docking starting about 12:15 a.m. Eastern Time and the hatch opening approximately 3 hours later. It's just, it's kind of a soft spot here at X Squared Radio. We love the space program. I love the folks down at JPL and everything that they do. I love all the support agencies that explore space, all the volunteers that monitor SETI and report on radio transmissions that they receive from space, if any, that are not artificial. And we hope for friendly contact, evidence that we're not alone in this universe, evidence that maybe we have progenitors or ancestors in far reaches of the galaxy that may stop by from time to time, maybe advanced civilizations here living on the Earth or visiting the Earth. Most people believe that. Some people know it. Agencies aren't saying anything. But it is a sore spot with me when we turn our backs on the spirit of exploration, when we raid the cookie jar of exploration and all of the windfall discoveries that are made in those programs that are transferred technology-wise to the private sector so that we can use them. Everything from Tang to digital watches to microcomputers to coatings to Velcro. So many private sector innovations that began with that magnificent brain trust of NASA. It has become a hiss and a byword among Congress. It's a necessary evil. It's one of those embarrassing stepchildren down in Florida. Doesn't get people elected anymore. They're not interested in it. So it pains me when the outsourcer in chief gives up on our manned space program and we have to buy a seat on someone else's ship. We were first. Interesting stuff going on in the world of terror control. That's sort of like bad breath control, isn't it? A war on anger, a war on frustration, a war on jealousy. It's just convenient, this thing. But a supercomputer that was supposed to help Britain's security service track, quote, terror suspects will not be ready in time for the Olympics. It's true. Interesting story, you know. MI5 has sacked a firm of IT consultants after the company failed to meet deadlines to implement the new intelligence checking system. The computer system is designed to help MI5 officers carry out secret searches on suspects, including those who may pose a threat at the Olympics. I don't want anybody threatening the Olympics. But spy chiefs have admitted that the software will not be ready in time to be safely trialed before the start of the games later this month. The new electronic records management system will bring together all MI5 intelligence material so officers can carry out complete searches of old and current records. For example, it would alert officers more quickly to archived intelligence on a terror suspect who had been dormant or lying low for a number of years. The IT failure comes days after the government announced that private security firm G4S had failed to hire enough guards for the Olympics. Ministers have been forced to call upon the army to make up the shortfall. One security source said of the MI5 IT project, "Of course it would be better if this was up and running in time for the Olympics, as it allows officers to search all their systems in one quick check. In a fast-moving investigation with finite resources, delay can mean the difference between success and failure." The new search facility is understood to work in a similar way to the high-tech computers used in the BBC TV series Spooks, where spies match pictures, names, and mobile phone numbers to identify suspects from all their records. Last night, security sources declined to name the company at the center of the IT controversy, nor would they say exactly why the firm had its contract terminated. But it is understood that the project, which is estimated to have already cost up to £1 million, has been plagued by technical and commercial difficulties. The decision to postpone implementation until after the Olympics leaves the taxpayer out of pocket, while MI5 must find a replacement contractor. It has emerged that Jonathan Evans, Director General of the Security Service, has voiced concerns about a number of costly IT security contracts, including the one that has been terminated. In a report published on Thursday by MPs from the Intelligence and Security Committee, Mr. Evans is quoted as saying, "I think it would be fair criticism to say that we have had some cases where our use of consultants and contractors hasn't been as controlled as it should be, but now we've got a proper focus. Post-Olympics, we intend to reduce the number of organizations and individuals we deal with and to manage those relationships more aggressively than we have done." A Whitehall security source said that the decision to postpone introducing the system until after the Olympics... What? Okay, I didn't use the whole English accent. That was just a really slight one. So, I know you don't want me to use the accent. That's okay. It's my radio program. You want to do fake accents? Get your own radio program. Okay, a Whitehall security source said that the decision to postpone introducing the system until after the Olympics was taken some time ago on the grounds that it would be too risky to introduce new software just before the Olympics. He said that while the delay would affect the service's capability, nobody was saying we desperately need the new system immediately now. It has also emerged that almost 500 officers from across MI5, MI6, and GCHQ have left the Secret Services in the past year at a cost of £47 million to the taxpayer. Many of the senior staff have been paid six-figure sums to take early retirement, while others have been given big redundancy payoffs. The 24 MI6 staff were paid a total of £4 million to leave the service as part of a drive to remove some of the most expensive spies from the payroll. Don't tell me they got rid of 007. That's not what I want to hear. Gee. At the government's secret listing post, GCHQ, 255 staff left under the approved early retirement terms in 2010-2011. The cost to the taxpayer of these exit packages was £23 million. But the director of GCHQ, Ian Laban, told MPs he had been forced to offer early retirement to reduce staff numbers and stay within budget. He said, "We've lost a number of more senior members of staff. As I shook hands with each of them, I felt a degree of regret. But we needed to get our figures down in order to hit our own spending review commitments." In this security service, 216 staff left under the services living within our means scheme. Of these, 103 left voluntarily, and the remaining 113 were redundancies. The cost to the taxpayer was £20 million. Jonathan Evans told the committee that part of the reason for the redundancy program was to change the staff mix. You can read into that anything that you want to read into it. And that in this sort of world where technologies come and go in a fortnight, some of the staff that we had weren't really the right people. What do you mean, you people? Come on. The MPs also said that all three agencies were struggling to retain staff as the private sector. And there is hope for freedom after all. Spies are being laid off. Dun, dun, dun. We like it. The great spy layoff. Can I see a show of hands of those that would rather see a spy laid off as an astronaut? Oh, yeah, see there, it's unanimous. Get rid of the spies. Keep the space exploration program open. I like it. You think like I do. It's good. You know, some of the things we have to go through in life just to get by day to day. I was having a conversation with a gentleman who personally didn't have a clue, but his wife, excuse me while I sip the last of my chilled grapefruit juice. It's been so hot today, I've lost so much water. I'm going to have to get me a second glass here for the third hour. Anyway, his wife was intimately aware of, and I shall I say supportive of, the new sweeping federal takeover of the healthcare industry. And I, you know, one of the things that I drew on the board, I said, look, here's the deal. Three things you really have to understand here. And I understand, I hear the buzzwords that you're saying. I can hear the marketing of your wife in your voice. First of all, there's a big difference between health insurance and health care. Nobody in this country has to do without health care. There's a doc in a box, a clinic, a low-cost clinic, just about on every street corner in every city in America. I belong to one that has several locations around the city. I can walk into any of them anytime they're open, and they're open until almost 9 o'clock at night without an appointment. And the copay is about what I would pay for insurance. It's about $35. I can go in there. They can check me out, take my blood pressure, look down my throat if I have a sore throat, give me stitches if I need stitches. They can do all the minor stuff, primary health care we call it, prescribe drugs, do treatments, all that stuff. And I don't need insurance. And I can pay for it out of my pocket. And if I don't have the money that day, which, I mean, who doesn't have $100? If you don't have $100, you can make payments. $10 a month for 10 months. $10 to go see a physician. Healthcare is available to everybody in this country, whether you're legal or illegal. Okay? You can walk into these clinics and get care. Now, health insurance is quite a different thing. Health insurance is a gambling venture. Nothing more, nothing less. It's a company who puts up money that they collect from premiums to pay for vastly inflated, and by vastly I mean up to 10 times more expensive, healthcare, and all the people that have their hand out along the way, from the time you walk into the hospital or the emergency room to the time you get that little bill in the mail with the remainder that your insurance didn't pay. There must be 30 or 40 people in that line. Every one of those people have to be paid. And it causes delays, which means that the healthcare provider might have to wait up to 90 days, sometimes 6 months, to receive their payment from the insurance company. And that's if they don't have to argue with the insurance company. The healthcare provider might say, well, this is $125. They send the bill in. The insurance company comes back and says, no, we're only going to pay $120, so you're going to have to eat $5 of that. And they'll argue over that for a couple of months. But you do that for a few thousand patients a month, and it really adds up to serious money. I mean, does it save in healthcare? Hell no. It bloats healthcare. I go to the doc in a box, and I get an MRI for $250. I go to the hospital and get it. It's $2,500 under insurance. 10 times as expensive. Don't fool yourselves. This is a gambling venture. What they do, they run statistics, and they're a dynamic process. They know exactly how many people are going to get cancer. They know exactly how many people are going to be killed in car wrecks. They know exactly how many people are going to fall out of airplanes and get kicked by horses and choke on a ham sandwich. They know this because they have statistics. They know precisely what their losses are going to be. Then they figure out how much money they want to make, and they set the premiums at that rate. It's a gambling venture, nothing more, nothing less. Insurance companies do not provide health care. The only thing they do is manage the cash, and they take a cut all along the way, like multiple dealers selling and reselling that invoice all the way up the chain. Now, obviously, it's a gambling venture, and so they don't want to take undue risk. And so for nearly a century, they don't take people they know already are a risk. So if you're not already in the system, and you can't be kicked out of the system if you're already in it, you want to enter the system with a pre-existing condition, they don't want to take you because you're already a known loss. They already know you're going to consume $500,000 in healthcare with a heart transplant or liver transplant or with, you know, bone cancer or whatever. They already know that you're going to run up a big bill. They can't collect it from you in premiums, so they don't want to take you. Well, now the government is forcing them to take you. So if you're going to get this extended health care to extend your life for another 18 months or 2 years or 5 years, I mean, less than 2 or 3% of these, any people with catastrophic illness like that are cured. They get put in remission, and they might get another 5 or 10 years out of their life. And that's it. You know, once you have cancer, you have cancer. That's the way it is. Can you live a little bit longer? Sure, you can. After your hair grows back, of course you can. Treatments are out there, and a lot of them work. But they're not prohibitively expensive. They're not planet-ending. They're not life-ending. They're not going to drive you into bankruptcy. The third thing is that there is a system that has been completely ignored, and that is called a medical savings account. This is where a person puts away his own money, say $5,000, maybe he can be helped to do that by the company that he works for. And then he has a catastrophic insurance plan. Catastrophic insurance plan covers the stuff over the $5,000. You basically have a $5,000 deductible, okay? And it could be a $10,000 deductible if you really want to make it affordable. Because 85% of the nation doesn't go to a doctor for 40 years. You know, once they get their last shot in elementary school, they don't go to the doctor again. Oh, you know, maybe strep throat or stitches or a broken bone or something like that. But they're not going to go to the doctor and rack up a big bill. 85% of the nation is at that point. They don't have insurance. They don't need insurance. They don't want insurance. Why spend $750 a month? You know, $9,000 a year for something you don't need. Why would I spend $9,000 a year so I can buy my blood pressure medicine at 10 bucks? It only costs me $19 if I pay cash for it. I'm going to spend $750 a month to save $9? You see, it doesn't make any sense. Because if it was coming out of your pocket, it wouldn't make sense to you either. And if you're asking a gambling company, insurance companies, these are big casinos. That's all they are. They run the odds. They know the odds. Now, the only way to make more money is to put more people in the system. You can't make people buy insurance. You can talk to them about it. You can talk to them about risks. But if you don't want to have it, you don't have to get it. You can pay for your own health care. That is until now. Now what's happened is the federal government is ordering you to buy insurance. And if you don't buy insurance, you have to pay a tax. You got to pay a penalty to the federal government because you're uninsured. Now, those are the three things that you need to understand. Once you understand that, you realize that not the average, way over the average, the majority of people can get by for $500 a year, not a month, a year in healthcare costs. That covers the sore throats, the ear infections, the stitches, the scrapes. If you do go to a doctor for that kind of stuff, first aid stuff, even second aid stuff, even advanced stuff, blood pressure, you know, diabetes, all that stuff. You know, insulin doesn't cost that much each month. It's $20 a month to $50 a month, sometimes $100 a month if you're a really bad user. But it's your disease. It's not anyone else's disease. So you're asking 300 million other people to contribute to a big pool, which I'm sure is going to be guarded and never robbed, never put into the general fund. Oh, no, they would never do that. It will be in a lockbox. And if it shows where it's making money, they'll cut back on the amount of premiums to make it affordable for most people. Don't bet your life on it. This thing will make Social Security look like a lemonade stand. We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars in cash. And once it gets in the hands of politicians, the agency government, you will never see it again. You know, I hope the Democrats get what they want. I really do. If the Democrats get what they want, you're going to have free work. You're going to have free clothing. You're going to have free housing. You're going to have free health care. You're going to have free food. The only thing that won't be free is you. And if you want to see how it works, there's a perfect model out there already. You can look at it. It's in full operation in China. I hope the Democrats get what they want. But in case you don't want to run up a big bill on dental bills, there is a new chemical that makes teeth cavity-proof. And it could do away with dentist visits forever. And, of course, it's being lobbied against by 4 out of 5 dentists. This is a story by Rob Waugh. A new chemical could make human teeth cavity-proof and do away with the need for visits to the dentists forever. Like I used to say when I was young, better living through chemicals. A new chemical, this molecule has been called Keep32 after the 32 teeth in a human mouth. Well, 30 in my case. The chemical was designed by dentists in Chile and wipes out all the bacteria that cause cavities in just 60 seconds in tests. The chemical could be added to any current dental care product, turning the toothpaste, mouthwash, and chewing gum into super cleansers that could get rid of the underlying cause of tooth decay. I like the toothpaste idea. Because generally, I don't swallow toothpaste. I sort of, you know, brush my teeth and floss. I floss first, then brush my teeth. And I spit that stuff down the drain. And then I rinse my mouth thoroughly with clean water. I don't like the idea. Mouthwash is okay. Swish, swirl, it's out. I mean, that's okay. Chewing gum I don't like because you don't spit. You swallow. And I don't know what Keep32 is going to do when it goes down through the intestines. I mean, it's going to kill that bacteria too. I need that stuff. Come on. I need that stuff in my small and large intestines. It's what keeps me alive. I don't want to kill all the bacteria in my gut, have a loose bowel for the rest of my life. You don't want to see that stuff. Ask your doctor about Keep32. And then the disclaimer starts. If you have blurred vision, or a ringing in the ears, or anal leakage, or you have thoughts of suicide, stop using Keep 32 immediately and call your doctor. Now, I think you can get this without prescription. I think the toothpaste is a good idea. Or maybe, you know, a little shot glass rinse that you do once a month. You know, you just kind of swish it around in your mouth, spit it out, rinse your mouth, and then brush your teeth. It wipes out all the bacteria that causes cavities in just 60 seconds. I like it. That would have saved me a lot of torturous days in the dentist chair when I was a kid. The chemical targets Streptococcus mutans, the bacteria that turns the sugar in your mouth into lactic acid, which erodes tooth enamel. By exterminating the bacteria, Keep 32 prevents the damage to teeth before it happens. Using a product containing the chemical keeps your teeth cavity-proof for several hours. The product has been under test for 7 years and is now going into human trials. It could be on the market in 14 to 18 months. I will be there in 15 to 19 months, I promise you that. Say researchers Jose Cordoba from Yale University and Eric Astudillo from the University of Chile. The chemical could even be added to the food to foods to stop bacteria damaging teeth as you eat. The researchers hope to license the patent to chemical giants such as Procter & Gamble. We are currently in talks with 5 interested in investing in our project or buy our patent. Now, you know what's going to happen if that happens. Come on now. 4 out of 5 dentists will get together and buy that patent, and we're going to be right back in the dentist chair seeing the dental hygienist. Okay? But you're still going to have to get plaque scraped off your teeth. You're still going to have to get your teeth professionally cleaned once a year. You should do that. Go in there and get those puppies buffed off. You know, get all the plaque removed. Make sure your gums are in good shape. Come on, people. It doesn't cost that much. Go in there, spend $100, bring your mouth back up to working order. People enjoy your smile and your breath. But I'm going to be looking for Keep 32. Hopefully they don't sell the patent and it gets buried by the American Dental Association. I mean, come on. That's going to put a lot of dentists out of business as far as cavities. Or they have to go back to school and become orthodontists. There's not a chemical out there that will automatically straighten your teeth. Just like my idea for spray abs never took off. Come on, man. You go in there with you're wearing a summer dress that you could have a six-pack under or a turkey. Who would know? Spray this on your abdomen. The fat melts off your body, and you instantly walk out with a beautiful six-pack ready for your bikini summer. Now, tell me that wouldn't be a big seller. It would be. Come on. Spray off about 5 inches around that waist. Works on butt cheeks, too. And I think you really couldn't even cash your first check if the folks down in Chile would just come up with a cream that would grow hair. Oh, yeah. You rub that on the male pattern baldness areas and grow back nice, fresh, permanent hair, you wouldn't be able to cash your first check. And I don't think there'd be anybody burying that patent, by the way, either. I don't think the Hair Club for Men would lobby against you. Not like the American Dental Association. You're going to have somebody harsh in your gig there, Jose. I'm just going to tell you right now. We are addicted to our cavities, if you know what I'm saying. Bring on the Heath Bar. By the way, all is not well in the southern borders. Closure of the Border Patrol stations across 4 states triggered some alarms on the 10th. The Obama administration is moving to shut down 9 Border Patrol stations across 4 states, triggering a backlash from local law enforcement members of Congress and Border Patrol agents themselves. It's sort of like ringing the dinner bell, right? Okay, nobody's watching. We've shut down the Border Patrol. You're on the honor system. Wink, wink, wink. Critics of the move warn the closures will undercut efforts to intercept drug and human traffickers in well-traveled corridors north of the U.S.-Mexico border. Though the affected stations are scattered throughout northern and central Texas and three other states, the coverage areas will see plenty of illegal immigrant activity. One soon-to-be-shuttered station in Amarillo, Texas, is right in the middle of the I-40 corridor. Another in Riverside, California, is outside Los Angeles. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says it's closing the stations in order to reassign agents to high-priority areas closer to the border in states where Obama is already ahead. These deactivations are consistent with the strategic goal of securing America's borders and our objectives of getting Obama reelected. I'm sorry, it doesn't say that. And our objective of increasing and sustaining the certainty of arrest of those trying to enter our country illegally. CBP, that's Centers Border Protection, spokesman Bill Brooks, no relation, said in a statement, by redeploying and reallocating resources at or near the border, CBP will maximize the effectiveness of the enforcement mandate and align our investments with the mission. But at least one Border Patrol supervisor in Texas has called on local officers to voice your concerns to elected officials, warning that the deactivation will remove agents from the Texas panhandle, among other areas. Several members of Congress have asked Border Patrol Chief Michael Fisher to reconsider the plan, and local officials are getting worried about what will happen once the Border Patrol leaves town, since they rely on those federal officials to assist in making immigration arrests. It could impact us tremendously, since we've only got two agents up here now for 26 counties, Potter County Sheriff Brian Thompson told Fox News. Potter County in the Texas Panhandle would be affected by the planned closure of the Amarillo Station. Thomas said that while his area is far from the border, it's still a major corridor for illegal immigrants, and he said that his office depends on Border Patrol to respond to their calls. I can't hold a carload of people out there on I-40 for 8 hours while somebody comes from El Paso, he said. I mean, that's just crazy. Border Patrol's resident agent in charge in Amarillo expressed similar worries in a recent memo to law enforcement alerting them to the planned closure. The official, Robert Green, warned that the entire complement of two agents would be reassigned from Amarillo to somewhere closer to the border. He said there's no active plan right now for immigration and customs enforcement to fill the void on assisting local office officials with stops. So I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do with this story. You know, empathizing with local officials, this guy writes, as a former deputy, I found myself on the other end of the radio hoping to contact USBP to assist me with a vehicle full of undocumented foreign nationals on the side of the road. And in an unusual plea, he urged the recipients of his memo to contact elected officials about the change. I would encourage you, if you have found USBP assistance valuable in the past, to contact your political representatives and voice your concerns, Green wrote. The letter was first posted online by the Lubbock Avalanche Journal. Thomas confirmed to FoxNews.com that he had received it from Bob Dane, communications director with the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Lawmakers have started to get involved, but I think it's going to be too little too late. This is already in the works. You can see what's going on. We mapped out already in a recent presentation that I made five states that have been targeted by the regime for basically disemboweling the immigration control forces in those states. The idea, I think, is to win brownie points with those people of the Hispanic persuasion to reelect Obama. And these are in states that Obama would normally not win. The Democrats, as far as the presidency, don't do well in these states. They're historically conservative, but they do have considerable Hispanic communities. And it's clear that some efforts are being made to buy influence. And I don't know how to put it any other way. So a lot of that is going on, and it's going on in your face, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. I mean, how financially burdensome are two agents at a Border Patrol station? You know, these guys are hopping all the time as law enforcement pulls up on broken down cars, undocumented people, not just Hispanic. Some of these are Yemenis, some are Iranians. They're in the country, they're undocumented, they come in through the Mexican border because it's so easy to get into the country. All you have to do is hop that fence and make your way to some, you know, populated area, go to the meat rack, and someone's going to hire you. There's places all over Santa Monica and Los Angeles. They're well known. Drive up in a pickup truck, say, I need two people to cut grass. I need two people to trim trees. I need two people to cut weeds, to haul trash, to help me empty out a warehouse for the day. And you can pay people. And people go there every single day to get work for cash. And it's a billion-dollar industry in this country. Now, admittedly, I don't think the teenagers of our country, American teenagers, are going to go down to the meat rack and try to get a job for a day or two or a week. I just don't see them there. But you definitely see undocumented people there looking for work. And generally, I've never heard of a disappointment. Usually work hard, they're skilled, they do good work, they're courteous, and they're available. So, you know, interesting stuff is going on all over the place. We're at 10 minutes at the top of the hour. I can probably cover this story in that amount of time, but it's probably going to spill over to the next hour because it's very, very interesting. Tree rings prove climate was warmer in Roman and medieval times than it is now. And the world has been cooling for 2,000 years. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Rings in fossilized pine trees. And pine trees are, you know, pretty fast growing, but these are fossilized pine trees. Have proven that the world was much warmer than previously thought, with measurements dating back to 138 BC. Rings in fossilized pine trees have proven that the world was much warmer than previously thought, and the Earth has been slowly cooling for 2,000 years. Measurements stretching back to 138 BC prove that the Earth is slowly cooling due to changes in the distance between the Earth and the Sun. The finding may force scientists to rethink current theories of the impact of global warming. Why? Well, just let me put this in parenthetically. If the trees are recording that Earth has been slowly cooling for 2,000 years, who has been warming it up? It is the first time that researchers have been able to accurately measure trends in global temperatures over the last two millennia. Over that, because we just didn't have accurate way to measure temperature, right? There are no thermometer measurements going back to 138 BC out there that we can just, you know, print out. But the trees, the fossilized trees, have that record. Over that time, the Earth has been getting cooler, and previous estimates used as the basis for current climate science are just wrong. Their findings demonstrate that this trend involves a cooling of 0.3 degrees C per millennium due to gradual changes to the position of the sun and an increase in the distance between the Earth and the sun. This figure we calculated may not seem particularly significant, said Esper. However, it is not negligible when compared to global warming, which is now up to less than 1 degree C. Our results suggest that the large-scale climate reconstruction shown by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the IPCC, likely underestimate this long-term cooling trend over the past few millennia. The finding was based on semi-fossilized tree rings found in Finnish Lapland. Professor Dr. Jan Esper's group at the Institute of Geography at JGU used tree ring density measurements from sub-fossil pine trees originating from Finnish Lapland to produce a reconstruction reaching back to 138 BC. In doing so, the researchers have been able for the first time to precisely demonstrate that long-term trend over the past two millennia has been toward climatic cooling. We found that previous estimates of historic temperatures during the Roman era and the Middle Ages were too low, said Esper. Such findings are also significant with regard to climate policy, as they will influence the way today's climate changes are seen in context of historical warm periods. The annual growth rings in trees are the most important witness over the past 1,000 to 2,000 years as they indicate how warm and cool past climate conditions were. Researchers from Germany, Finland, Scotland, and Switzerland examined tree ring density profiles in trees from Finnish Lapland. In this cold environment, trees often collapse into one of the numerous lakes where they remain well-preserved for thousands of years. The density measurements correlate closely with the summer temperatures in this area on the edge of the Nordic taiga. The researchers were thus able to create a temperature reconstruction of unprecedented quality. The reconstruction provides a high-resolution representation of temperature patterns in Roman and medieval warm periods, but also shows the cold phases that occurred during the migration period and the later Little Ice Age. In addition to the cold and warm phases, the new climate curve also exhibits a phenomenon that was not expected in this form. For the first time, researchers have now been able to use the data derived from tree rings to precisely calculate a much longer-term cooling trend than has been playing out over the past 2,000 years. So I reiterate at the close of this hour, if the climate has been cooling for 2,000 years, is it possible that the activities of mankind have been enough to raise the temperature of the Earth 1 degree C? It's a legitimate question, my friends. It's a legitimate question. Now, you might say, and I have said in the past myself, if a volcano erupts, pumps more CO2 and methane and other gases and particulate matter into the upper atmosphere than all of the thinkings and doings of mankind for 50 years. Yes, that's true. But it does it acutely. That is to say, it does it all at once. And Earth has an ability to rebound from things that happen all at once. Whether it's a Mount St. Helens or a Krakatoa or a Pompeii, or whether it's an earthquake or a tsunami, Earth has a way of rebounding, or a BP oil spill. These acute events we can recover from pretty quickly because the planet is just built to do that. But chronic exposure, a chronic elevation in chlorofluorocarbons in high altitude, a chronic influx of high concentration CO2 and carbon monoxide and nitrous oxides and unburned hydrocarbons into the atmosphere over a period of 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years does have its effect on the planet. We are seeing it in layers of ice, Earth explorers. It's been captured going way, way back to the late 1800s. I know that's a long way, isn't it? But mankind has been burning one thing or another for 2,000 years to stay warm. You'll remember the story of, you know, keep the home fires burning kind of thing. But the coal smoke and soot in London became mixed with a dense fog, and it formed a poisonous acid kind of fog that was killing people. You had to stay inside your home. If you went out and breathed that stuff, it would kill you. It was a toxic fog. This is the kind of chronic chemical exposure that we've been doing to our planet. And we're burning more oil, diesel and gasoline, than we've ever burned before. And it's going up. It's going up. There are countries that are coming online when it comes to automobiles. And I can tell you right now, because I've been to those countries, they don't have smog controls on those vehicles. They're still running carburetors. They run the exhaust fumes straight into the atmosphere without going through any catalytic converter, no kind of fuel management system. There's no inspection. How many milligrams per mile are you putting out? None of that. None of the third world countries and most of the first world countries do not have this. Israel, yes. Europe, yes. UK, yes. But Asia, India, Africa, forget about it. Those vehicles are just like the old 1970 Volkswagen. In fact, you could still buy the 1972 Volkswagen manufactured in Mexico. Engine, transmission, body, everything, all transferred to Mexico. Literally, up until the mid-90s, you could buy that car brand spanking new from the factory in Mexico with a carburetor. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Not even a fuel-injected air-cooled motor. A carbureted Volkswagen, old school, points, coil, you name it. Not even electronic ignition. Yeah, believe me, it was there. It's running. And that's just south of our border. So that's our air, too. So we have been having a chronic effect on the climate, and we have seen a 1 degree C increase in temperature in 100 years, where we were seeing a 2,000-year decrease in temperature. Natural undulations, or are we having a chronic effect on the planet? I can ask you to decide, but I would really like to know what your thoughts are. 888-429-5471. We'll be right back after this from Muse. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you. Interesting stuff going on out there. I think that we all have our fears and our weaknesses, but I also think we have our strengths. We have things that we search for, things that we hope for, things that we dream about. And those dreams are great. Those dreams are the driving force of our lives. If you stop dreaming, you're just breathing and going from day to day. If you're living to work, I think you got your priorities wrong. You need to work to live. You need to dream large. Look out there to the stars. Look inside for the greatness that you imagined when you were young. Dreams that you forgot about. Things that you hoped for, things that you missed, things that you want to be, things that you want to do, places that you want to see, books that you want to read, things that you want to experience. Look out there. Good planets are hard to find, but life, mortal life, and the things that you do and the things that you are, that's what's great. Nobody is going to count all the toys in your garage. Nobody's going to count the value of your bank accounts. Nobody is going to count the number of collectibles you have in your cases, or the land that you own, or the stock that you trade. That's not the point. The point is that you come here and you experience time. You experience beauty and challenge. You get to taste food and listen to music. You get to meet one another and love each other and challenge each other. And you get to slow things down so that you live one flash in the cosmic reality and stretch it out to 100 years, sleeping and waking and aching and loving your way through that 100 years. You get to set goals and achieve them and fail, which is part of it as well. Nobody succeeds at everything they try. That's not the point. If he did that, what would be the challenge? Failure is part of it. Failure is a treasure of mortality. It doesn't go away. It makes you strong. It doesn't beat you down. It builds you up. It makes the medal, the trophy, the honor, the satisfaction with what you do count even more. You can overcome it, and you will not dwell on the negative. You will not dwell in fear. You will have courage, and you'll have hope. And when others let you down, you will look for the good in those people and help them to see it themselves. I think this is the true purpose of life. It is not to suffer and to believe. It is to grow and see the glory of the divinity of the human soul reach the fullness of its potential. You know this in your heart. No matter what religion you belong to, no matter what dogma you adhere to or have thrown away, it is of no consequence. When this is all done and you close your eyes for the last time as a mortal, you exhale your last breath. You will not cease to exist, but you will be at a vibrational level that you yourself chose. You will judge yourself by your thoughts and by the action you took upon those thoughts, no one else. There is no bearded man sitting out in space or in another dimension that judges you. You do that. You do that every moment of every day. And I implore you, plead with you, encourage you. Judge well, my friends. Judge well. As we move into this third hour, I want to let you know, as you're making plans for the rest of this year, we are now well past the spring equinox or spring solstice. We are now heading for shorter days, longer nights, and some exciting stuff. In October, you can make your plans to join me at the Pythagoras Conference. Sandra Sabatini and myself are putting on a magnificent conference in southern Indiana. Other speakers are joining us from around the world, 50 in all. We have never had an event like this in the Midwest. This is an opportunity, the first of its kind that I can remember, that I know of. Usually you have to go to the West Coast or you have to go to Europe or something, but not in the Midwest. Sandra Sabatini has done a magnificent job putting this together. And we need your support. We need your patronage, and you need to be there. And we're making it easy. You go to xsquaredradio.com and you click on the blue banner that says Pythagoras Conference, and you get $100 off. And it's worth it. You don't have to fly. You don't have to have a passport. You don't have to go through any pat downs. You can drive there. because it's within an eight-hour drive of 73% of the nation's population. You live close to this. It's in the neighborhood. Click on the blue banner at xsquaredradio.com and sign up today for the Pythagoras Conference. I want to see you there. The next major event is called Maya 2012. I don't think there's been an event like this, well, in 26,000 years. This is ground zero. This is where the Maya calendar comes around to midnight. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. There is a place on Earth where that began. It is called Chichen Itza. And actually, it's the calendar was explained on the tomb of Pakal, where it was discovered in Palenque. Now, you can go to Palenque and you can climb down in the crypt, and if it's still open, and you can see the tomb lid for yourself. Or you could just read the Ark of Millions of Years series and learn all about it, because my co-author E.J. Clark is a world expert on it. Plus, we have had Jose Arguez on this planet. On this planet. Yes. And on this program, interviewed on this program, talking about his discovery of the Pakal tomb lid shortly after it was uncovered in 1958. He was on this program and explained it to us. You can go back in the archives of X Squared Radio and you can listen to that interview for yourself. Or, and on top of that, you can join us in Chichen Itza down in the Yucatan. We're leaving on the 13th, and we're coming back on the 22nd of December. Yes, that's right. You're going to spend December 21st, 2012, at Ground Zero in Chichen Itza with me, Greg Braden, Maureen St. Germain, Mayan elders, and you might as well bring some stories home. Go to the orange banner at X Squared Radio, Maya 2012. Click on it. Register today. Join me in December. Let's go to the phones. Alan Steinfeld, welcome to the program. Right.
Thank you, Brooke. What do you expect to happen? I mean, on December 21st, do you think there'll be some major consciousness shift?
Well, I think the consciousness shift has already begun. I have seen it. Since we published our book in 2004, I mean, you know, come on, Alan, we published this book. There were probably five titles on 2012 way back then. In the next 5 years, there must have been 200 titles that came out. And I had no idea people were interested in this stuff, honestly. Yes, I definitely think there's a consciousness shift occurring. And I see the stratification across the planet. Everywhere I travel, I see it. You have the awake and the aware. And I see that not necessarily in the New Age genre. In fact, I see a lot of dark hearts and lost souls in the New Age genre. I see these people in Baptist congregations. I see them at baseball games and karaoke bars. I mean, it's amazing how many awake and aware people there are that are running a higher vibration. And they're slowly separating, now more rapidly than then, from the dark hearts of this planet. All of the Fox News, you know, tear the world apart, everything's in crisis, going to war world. It's going its way, and we're going our way. What do you think?
Well, I think it has been happening for a long time. I met Jose Arguez in 1987 when he proclaimed the harmonic convergence as the end of the last 25 years before the countdown. And right. He says that was an ending of a 52-year cycle that began in 1519 when Cortez invaded Mexico. So this is the ending of a great cycle. And I do think on December 21st, 2012, there'll be some dramatic changes interdimensionally, higher cons. I think we'll see something. That's my feeling. Who knows?
You know, here's the way I look at it from a physics point of view. I look at 7 billion people alive on the earth today, and I look at a significant portion of them now reaching this crescendo of consciousness. We are integrally tied to the energy grid of this planet. I think the planet is, in some senses, a living thing, but it's certainly an energy system. And when a significant portion of the population, literally billions of people on this planet, raise their vibrational level, it's going to reach a point at which you're exactly right. And I think the Maya were correct 1,500 years ago when they predicted this, that the planet would reach a point where it transitions possibly into another dimension.
Well, I think the dimension actually is here, but the latent potential in the human brain is what's being activated now as the Earth increases its vibration, as we move into a new place in the galaxy, getting more light infused into us as the solar flares increase, the solar radiation. All of this is coming together to activate something that has been waiting inside of us to bloom, to blossom. And I think that's the next dimension of the human existence.
I have a feeling that maybe it has to do a little with that, and also with the position in the galaxy, mm-hmm. the solar system going through the precession of the equinoxes. We're at a point now where this is a familiar neighborhood that the Maya calendar records. It punctuates itself with, and we're in that neighborhood, and we're being not only exposed to solar radiation, I think we're being exposed to galactic frequencies.
I agree, yes, and maybe this is what the Mayans saw as we align with what they call the womb, the black hole at the center of the galaxy. Whatever happened to your expedition to the inner Earth? Because I do believe there's a civilization inside the Earth as well.
Well, we made a major announcement on June 14th on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. We have received official endorsement from a Park Avenue production company. They are going to be pledging the funding this month or early next month for the charter of the ship. And we are leaving in July of 2013 with 100, which will be made of filmmakers, IT people, so we can get the images out while we're on the ship. 5 universities of grad students doing various experiments and measurements to try to determine if we've actually arrived at an opening into the inner Earth. And there's, other aspects to the expedition which we strongly believe could have some influence. Obviously, we're not taking a 450-foot long, 23,000-ton nuclear-powered icebreaker inside the planet. But if we're near the opening and we're sort of awaiting consciousness signal, maybe they will come out to see us, and if they do, we'll get it on film.
So where are you going to leave from? And you're heading towards the North Pole or the South Pole? North Pole, I suppose.
It's the Arctic, yes. That's the seas have never been sailed before. If they have, they've been military, and I'm sure they're willing to give us everything they know. This portion of the Arctic Sea opened up in 2007 when a continent-sized piece of the polar ice calved itself and floated away. So it has not been sailed since 2007. This is one of 3 ships that are authorized to sail this area. And we expect to be north of San Joseph Islands, not the North Pole. These ships go to the North Pole twice every year. This will be about 500 miles away from the North Pole. It's an area in Russian waters. And we'll be leaving out of Murmansk, Russia, north of St. Petersburg.
Uh-huh. So if people want to go on this trip, is that a possibility?
It's a possibility. Not a high probability, but it's a possibility. There are 38 openings left, which we call discretionary openings. Right now we have about 4,000 applicants for those 38 seats. So it is possible, yes. You go to NPIEE.org, NPIEE.org, and fill out the contact sheet, and you'll be in the database.
Well, yeah, I from what I've read and heard and listened to intuitive saying that there's a great civilization inside the Earth, and they are waiting for us to evolve to a level of consciousness where we can interact with them. Is that what you get?
I hope so. I don't think our governments are doing a good job, and certainly the agency governments are not doing a good job, but I hope we are.
But it's up to them if they want to meet, you know, representatives from the surface, because we are sort of barbaric. We're a barbaric race.
Well, that's true, but officially we are not representatives of people that live on the surface. We are only emissaries, and if they will come out and meet with us, we will show them to the world via satellite uplink, and the world will know what we know.
And how do you think that will change the planet and who we are as a civilization?
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. I've speculated 100 times. We estimate there are somewhere between 40 and 50 million people on Earth that know about this expedition. We won the Genes of Galileo contest in 2007 with our film in Japan. 17 million people watched it in one night, so I know that there are people that know about this venture. What it will do for them, I have received the most unbelievable mail over the years about this adventure. It means so much to people on so many levels. I think it will be the fulfillment of some dreams that they've been having. But what will it do generally for the planet? I think it will add to the division between those that are at a higher vibrational level and those that remain in fear and domination.
Could, or it could snap people out of those levels of fear and domination. Just like I think disclosure, the government disclosing what they know about UFOs, could wake people up to some higher truth that exists. So I think it could have a similar effect.
Doubt in people's minds that UFOs exist. I don't think there's any doubt in people's minds that the government is holding back information. What the people, I think, are losing faith in and what their hearts are really broken over is the jig is up. We already know this stuff. But the fact that the government continues to hold on to it is like a kid, you know, swearing that he didn't steal $100 after you caught him red-handed. It's a testimony against the integrity of those officials whom we have elected. They need to come clean in order to, I mean, they have what, an 8% approval rating? They could probably double it to 20% or more if they just come clean and say, okay, we know all about it. Here's all the evidence. I agree with you.
Well, of course, it would change our technology, our reliance on oil, because they do have, obviously, a higher technology that would fuel the planet that I'm sure our government knows about. So that's part of the problem, I think, is with the oil companies controlling the government and suppressing the information. So,
there's a question about that. I had a long argument in writing with somebody the other day when I claimed that the EPA was working for the oil companies, and they said, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, if the EPA was working for the oil company, we see oil rigs everywhere, popping up everywhere. They'd be unrestricted. And I said, no, you're absolutely wrong. The EPA's job is to limit the supply so that they can keep the price up, because the price of oil is being used as a weapon against China. That's the EPA's job, is to prevent new technology from coming online to lower the price of oil by competing against it.
I see. So what would China do with the lower oil prices? Develop their technologies, you're saying?
Yeah, China would explode, absolutely. If oil became cheap for China, their technology is at the point right now they could mechanize so fast. They have the cash, they have the expertise, they have the raw materials, they have cornered the market on rare earth metals and rare earth magnets.
And they have the manpower, obviously.
Well, that there's no question. I mean, come on. Everybody from Macintosh to Boeing is building stuff in China.
Mm-hmm. So with cheaper oil for China, they would just maximize the world economy, you're saying?
No doubt about it. And you put into consideration also that the Russian economy is almost completely oil-based. And if oil drops below $100 a barrel, Russia has no choice but to go to war. And they're already moving.
Yeah, but why isn't, I mean, getting back to China, why isn't China developing the free energy technologies? Obviously, it would be great for them to have that.
Well, they are trying to do that. They cornered the market on rare earth magnets. They make the most powerful magnets in the world. They are the only source of those high-powered magnets. And they're making magnetic motors and magnetic generators. They dominate the world in electric bikes and electric cars. They make all the world's solar panels. They've effectively put every solar panel company in the United States out of business, or they supply them the chips to make their solar panels. Absolutely. They're leading the world in technology.
Uh-huh. So they're eventually going to take over the market anyway, with or without lower oil prices. It seems like, you know, they'll be the world leader in industry because.
Well, you have to consider that oil is really, really cheap energy. I mean, for roughly 20 cents, you can take five of your friends and you a mile. You couldn't find a rickshaw driver in Shanghai to take you and five of your friends a mile for 20 cents. Oil is super cheap. It's just not clean and it's not sustainable.
Right. And it is, yeah, it is what the wars have been about. So eventually something's going to give with the oil companies and or some great genius will come along and say, here, you just put this thing in the air and you plug into it, right? I mean, isn't that what Tesla did?
Well, yes, but Tesla was kept on the edge of vagrancy his entire life. It's sort of like these guys down in Chile that have developed this new chemical to eliminate the need for dentists, you know, to fill cavities.
What's that?
It's called Keep32, and it's already gone through 7 years of clinical trials. It's now ready for human trials. And they estimate it will be in toothpaste in 14 to 18 months. Once they put this in toothpaste, dental TK is done. It's over. No more cavities. This kills the bacteria that turn sugar into lactic acid, which is what causes tooth decay.
But what's the name of that? What did you say?
It's called Keep 32. You can do a Google search on it, but it's
K-E-E-P, Keep?
Yeah, like Keep 32 teeth.
Keep 32. Okay.
Right.
That sounds like, I'll tell my dentist about it, actually.
Jose Cordoba from Yale University and Eric Astudillo from University of Chile have patented it, and right now they're looking for licensors, probably Procter & Gamble. I hope that they don't sell this patent, because if they sell this patent, we are doomed to drill for the rest of our lives. That chemical will never see the market.
So it's a chemical you put on your teeth and gets rid of tooth decay completely.
Yes, it kills the bacteria that causes tooth decay, and it lasts for about 3 or 4 hours. So right now, if you brush your teeth twice a day, you could literally go your entire life and never have a cavity.
Great. Well, thanks for all the work, and I'll keep listening, Brooke.
Alan, thanks so much. I appreciate you coming on. By the way, you're the host of New Realities Radio, right?
Exactly, and actually tonight in about a half hour, I'll be interviewing this woman, Judy Carroll, about her contact with the Zetas, the Gray Zetas.
Awesome. Well, you're a one-hour program every Sunday night, or are you on more nights?
No, I just have some time. She was available Sunday night. I usually am on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m., and people can also check out my website, New Realities, where I interview people from Deepak Chopra to Ram Dass to unknown shamans in the jungle. You know, I try to cover the whole scope of consciousness and how we're evolving. And I've definitely been investigating the 2012 myth for 25 years, and I do think something is coming. I think something very exciting, and we've seen the beginnings of it, but what's coming, I think, may surprise all of us in a good way, in a very positive way.
I think you're right. I'm going to go forward with life as though that is the truth. And I think it will happen that way.
And maybe I'll have you as a guest on my show at some point for a whole hour. We can talk about the expedition to the inner Earth. And,
I'd love to do that. I'd love to do that. You just name the day.
Okay. Let me see when I have some space for some new guests, and we'll do it.
All right. Okay. Excellent. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Brooke. Okay.
Good night. That's Alan Steinfield, and he is the host of New Realities Radio Tuesday nights, and we're lucky to have him tonight on X Squared Radio. Thanks, Don, for bringing him on. Don's my traditional producer out in Paradise. Yes, yes, Paradise, California. And his brother, Doug, have, in my opinion, the best webcast network in the world. Certainly consistently great quality, great hosts. It's used to be said, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS radio. I tend to agree, since the mainstream is usually full of dead stuff floating downhill. Or, you know, we're swimmers here at BBS Radio. We swim upstream, so there will be fish next spring. That's just what we do here. We're alive, awake, aware, and we're not flowing downstream with any dead stuff. And we appreciate the good crew out in Paradise, California. By the way, if you have the gumption, the desire to try your hand at talk radio, this is the place. This is the place. My good friend Ramon Almonte and his partner Joe are on 100th Monkey Radio. They're here on BBS Radio Network because of X Squared Radio. If you want to try your hand at being a talk radio host, please contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I will put in a good word for you, and we'll get you a spot, and you can try your hand. Used to be a lot more than it is today. We used to get about 1,000 new webcast radio programs a month, and about 1,005 quit. Because there's more to this than meets the ear. Now we're down to probably 200 or 300 a month trying their hand at webcast radio, various networks. But running a network takes a real dedication. It takes a real love. It takes a real passion. And that is what Doug and Don Newsom have. They have the passion. They have the love. And although I've tried my stint at AM radio in Chicago and Phoenix and Tucson and various places around the country, I always come back to BBS radio. I've never left in 8 years, almost 8 years now, because they have the passion and they have the dedication. They've helped me become a better host. They've helped me refine my art, and they can help you too. So contact me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and we'll see if you have what it takes. Well, you know, we've talked about on this program, and you've heard in the news about the God particle. It's sort of the big marketing campaign for CERN. Now, they had the super collider in Texas, and that kind of got defunded and did some work and didn't. But CERN is the granddaddy of all super colliders. It has received so much money, and the technology is so good. You know, it was a subject of Angels and Demons with Dan Brown's book. Great, great actors, and Tom Hanks, you know, bringing that whole story of the CERN as part of the build-up to the story in that movie. And CERN had its share of disasters. When they turned it on, the magnets were so strong that they literally tore the brackets loose and crushed part of it, and it took about 6 months to fix. But in a paper published this week, Ian Lowe, Joseph Lycan, and Gabe Shaughnessy of Cornell have cast doubt on what exactly was detected within the Hadron Collider. Was it, or was it not, the God particle? Signals detected from the Large Hadron Collider were hailed as conclusive proof that the God particle, the Higgs boson, had been found after a quest spanning nearly five decades. This was the holy grail of physics. To find that particle, the Higgs boson, Higgs without going into a long, long story, the Higgs event was the trigger that caused the Big Bang. Theoretically, the entire universe was slammed into a singularity somewhere in the void. Well, there's so much gravity from all the mass that makes up the universe, nothing escapes, not light, not radiation, nothing. So no particle's going to escape. But somehow the whole thing just one day exploded and created the universe. In a few billionths of a second, it looked pretty much the way it looks now. Well, that trigger, that rubber band that snapped somewhere inside that whole bunch of mass is called a Higgs event. And the Higgs boson has been the holy grail of this event. A week after the discovery of a particle believed to be the elusive particle, scientists at Cornell University have said they're not so sure. In a paper published this week, Ian Lowe, and of course Mr. Leica and Mr. Shaughnessy, have cast their doubts. The new resonance discovered by the ATLAS and CMS experiments at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, could be the long-sought Higgs boson of the Standard Model, say the scientists. Now, the Standard Model, for those of you that are not mathematicians, I'm not going to bore you with it. It's a matrix, not like the movie. It's a matrix mathematics, okay? If you take algebra, you'll know what I'm talking about. Matrix mathematics is a simple way for physicists to weigh and compare a lot of variables in one formula. So the Standard Model generates a lot of infinities and a lot of zeros, neither of which we like. But it also, if we eliminate those things, cancel them out, so to speak, by adding the same thing to both sides of the equation, we get numbers that we can use as relationships, sort of like E is equal to MC squared. Is it exact? You know, maybe not. Maybe there's some constant or some variable that's missing from that. But generally, it tells us the relationship between energy, mass, and the speed of light. That's what the Standard Model does. So that the Standard Model is a matrix. But the researchers pointed out that it's far from certain that the particle is the Standard Model Higgs, which scientists have sought for decades to fill in the gaps in the model of physics we currently use to explain the universe. We show that certain Large Hadron Collider data already strongly disfavor both the dilatonic and the non-dilatonic singlet impostors. On the other hand, a generic Higgs doublet and a triplet impostor give equally good fits to the measured event rates of the newly observed scalar resonance. The researchers advise caution and say that currently the uncertainties in these quantities are too large to make a definite statement. In other words, sometimes we make predictions and we have with that prediction what's called a confidence interval. We can say we have a 90% confidence interval that this is true, or a 93%, or a 95%, or the elusive 98%. But still, there's a plus or minus. It's called the uncertainty. When you draw a line through a cloud of data to come up with a slope of increase, not all that data is on the line, right? This line is sort of the average or the mean slope through that information. The uncertainty is the distance, the average distance that the dots are from the line. So if you're going through a bunch of data that's generally aligned in a straight line, you get a nice fit. It's called the R squared value. You get a 0.99999, four nines, which means you're 99.99% almost on the line. As you get further out there, 9992, 998, 995, it means that the uncertainty, the distance away from that line of perfection that you're looking at, becomes larger than what the resolution that you're trying to determine. So it means that you're outside the margin of error. And that's what these guys are saying. One of the reasons for the caution at CERN is that while the new particle has so far behaved like the elusive Higgs boson, it is lighter than expected. There's a certain mass that's expected from this particle, because obviously it's got to be like a little, you know, quantum sledgehammer in order to get this Higgs thing going. This is the rubber band that snapped that caused the Big Bang. This opens up the possibility of there being more than one Higgs boson and could lead to a new understanding of dark matter, the mysterious substance thought to make up a quarter of the universe. Actually, it's much larger than that, much larger than a quarter. Professor Higgs, 83, wiped a tear from his eye as the findings were announced and later said, "It's really an incredible thing that it's happened in my lifetime." Professor Tejinder Verdi of Imperial College London, who helped lead one of the two teams of scientists behind the discovery, said, "This breaks the way to looking at a new vista in physics. It's a very exciting moment." You know, by the way, if you look at the photographs of CERN, and you can go to the CERN site and look these up, you look at the scope of what they have built there. I'm not talking about something little. I mean, this thing is steel girders, you know, enameled in white, and it's all symmetrical. Huge cooling pipes with insulation and stainless steel corrugated on the outside, all strapped into place. It is, you know, even with the scaffolding, it is more beautiful than anything in the Prometheus movie. It's really a tremendous accomplishment. If you get a chance to go to Geneva and take a tour of CERN, you should see it. It's made of three accelerators. They're not concentric circles. They're tangential circles. That is to say, it's a circle with a larger circle and a big circle, about 27 kilometers in diameter, that touch each other on one edge. So it's sort of like a tire inside a tire inside a tire rolling on the street. Tangential, which means tangentially they touch. And what they do is they accelerate hydrogen protons, the electrons stripped off in the very beginning by a large battery. And then they begin pouring energy into these protons as they accelerate them. So normally they start out at about one electron volt. And they get them all the way up to multiples of tera electron volts, okay? So you go from one electron volt to millions, billions of electron volts, okay? Tera electron volts, which means these protons are massive. And they're traveling at 99.8% the speed of light. And then the packets, we always form them in packets. We divide the packets up, hopefully evenly, something like 64 protons in this packet and 64 packet in that packet. Maybe it's a little larger, but it's fairly even. They're divided and sent down parallel tracks to parallel tubes where they're traveling at 99.8% the speed of light. And then the two tracks cross paths like a figure eight. And so what happens is these protons slam into each other. Now, it's not super high probability. It takes several trips around this thing at pretty close to the speed of light before they actually get a head-on collision. You get a lot of glancing blows and things like that, but a head-on collision will splatter the protons apart, and when they splatter apart, they do so in a crash zone that has it's laden with all kinds of sensors, which are digital, which are very sensitive to specific frequencies, and then they can spectrographically look at the traffic accident and tell what's going on, and that's how they discover this particle. They know how much it's supposed to weigh, which means it's got to have a certain frequency, and it's outside of that range, but it happens to be, you know, a fit to the standard model, even though the margin of error is a little high. If the particle was shown not to exist, it would have meant tearing up the standard model and going back to the drawing board. Nobody wants to do that. Although the standard model is like one of those formulas that you can get whatever you want to get if you just manipulate the numbers right. I'm not saying that it's illegitimate. I'm just saying that if you get a number you don't like, something close to zero or something close to infinity, you can cancel that out by adding it to both sides of the equation And you can zero things out in order to zero in on what you're trying to look at. It changes the relationship. It keeps the relationship the same, but it changes the values in order to compensate for those things added to both sides of the equation. One of the reasons for the caution at CERN is that while the new particle has so far behaved like the elusive Higgs boson, it is definitely lighter. And that means that it could be something else. Or, like I said, there could be two or three or 100 or 1,000 bosons that match the Higgs. The theory has it that the universe cooled after the Big Bang and an invisible force known as the Higgs field formed. This field permeates the cosmos and is made of countless numbers of tiny particles, or Higgs bosons. As other particles pass through it, they pick up mass. In December last year at the Large Hadron Collider, the Big Bang Particle Accelerator, which recreates conditions a billionth of a second after the birth of the universe, revealed they had caught a first tantalizing glimpse of the Higgs. Since they have sifted through vast quantities of data from innumerable high-energy collisions in an effort to reduce the odds of being wrong. Now, I have not very much time left. I got about 5 minutes left, and I want to give you a Drone Wars update. There's a lot of information to go over here. I'm going to play a quick audio link, and then I'm going to talk to you about this. Believe it or not, drones are not just in the air. They're now under the water. I want you to listen closely. You're not going to believe this. Well, it appears to be nothing but video. I am not hearing any audio from this. But suffice it to say that they have come up with a 2-foot missile. This 2-foot missile can be mounted to a drone. That's right. You could be seeing drones with missiles. They don't have to be Hellfire missiles. They don't have to be Sidewinders flying around up there. Little drones, 6-foot wingspans, almost impossible to see when they're high in the sky, flying along at 100 or 200 miles an hour, and they're carrying 2-foot missiles. I was just trying to see if there's any usable audio on this. Nope, just looks like pictures. All right, well, the point is that now they've got mini missiles. And they've also got underwater drones. Amid concerns of Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz during a potential crisis, the U.S. Navy is beginning to develop and release a set of underwater drones to find and destroy sea mines present in the Persian Gulf. Multiple news outlets reported Thursday that tensions concerning Iran's nuclear program set in the motion reinforcement of U.S. military personnel and weaponry in the region, specifically in the form of the Sea Fox, a 4-foot, 88-pound, unmanned underwater surveillance vehicle that's guided by a remote control, weighs less than a 10-year-old. In February, the Navy implemented dozens of Sea Fox drones after an immediate request by Marine General James Mattis, the head of U.S. commander, serving in the Middle East, according to the media reports. The underwater drones have been arriving in recent weeks, not a coincidence considering the talks between the U.S. and Iran over the fate of Iran's nuclear development program have stalled. Officials have said that the advent of the underwater drones could pose a significant commercial threat to maritime traffic. I don't think so. The Los Angeles Times reports that the first Sea Fox drones have been developed by a German company that was once owned by BAE Systems, the British defense juggernaut. The Sea Fox drone might be new to American military strategies, but the model has been around for some time, costing around $100,000 each. Wow, that's expensive for 88 pounds. The Sea Fox drone has been made available for a decade and is currently used by 10 countries, including Great Britain, according to the Times. So when you couple the fact that we've got these 88-pound underwater drones, and we've got Raytheon's tiny little 2-foot missile, a tenth the weight of the Hellfire missile. They say they're just tweaking the software and running some environmental tests, and they're ready to go. That would open new worlds of possibility for the U.S. drone arsenal. There are a lot more small drones than there are Predators and Reapers. You know, those run around $1.4 million apiece. The small fry robots are used as flying spies since they're too lightweight to arm until now. The small tactical munition is supposed to arm the Shadow. That's a drone that's only 12 feet long. Come on, that's shorter than a Honda Civic. The U.S. fleet of killer drones would significantly increase. Alternatively, so we could go from 30,000 drones to 300,000 drones. Alternatively, the existing large killer drone fleet could carry far more weapons than they currently do, because they could carry these short little two-foot missiles. There are two ways to look at that development. Well, three. I'm going to offer a third. The straightforward way is to consider it kind of deadly Moore's Law. That's certainly commensurate with the miniaturization of killer drones, like the kamikaze mashup of missile and robot called the Switchblade. Less intuitive interpretation, not mutually exclusive with the other one, is that a smaller drone war might not be a deadlier one, because you'd have drones fighting drones. A small munition with a smaller warhead kills fewer people than a large munition. Oh, how merciful. That's certainly how Raytheon sees it. This is relevant to the strict rules of engagement, said J.R. Smith from its missiles shop. That's probably cold comfort if the armed robot fleet expands from hundreds to thousands before a single new bot is purchased. But not all drones are equal. The Shadow has a loiter time of about four hours aloft before it runs out of gas. A Predator can hover for the better part of a day, but having an armed Shadow to launch would be a big asset to a commando team in, say, East Africa. Smaller also means cheaper and easier to deploy. Well, that does it for X Squared Radio tonight. I encourage you, if you're out there, let's see if we can develop a drone-killing drone, something that weighs about 10 pounds, and the only thing it can do is take out drones. Then maybe we can launch those like mosquitoes. In fact, we could call it the Mosquito, and we could take out the drones that they intend to deploy over the United States. Let's see if we can close out tonight. Got a little bit different closing music. This has been X Squared Radio. We come to you every Sunday night for 3 hours east of the Appalachians, every Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific. We encourage you to look for the good in others and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying peace, Earth Explorers.